This is Kenneth Doust, and welcome to New World Notes, installment number 104. The title is Hannibal Lecter to Replace Dodd in Senate, or Psychopaths, an Introduction. An old book I once read had a quotable quote that went something like, "There is nothing new under the sun." And that sentiment goes for ideas, too. I don't think anybody's had a completely original idea. There are, of course, new and original combinations of dots, new and original ways of connecting a combination of dots. I've done that myself on occasion. But the dots themselves, the ideas, are as old as the hills. And so are most of the connections that are being made. I sound like I'm criticizing your in-laws, but I'm actually telling a tale of myself. For a few years, I've been seeing more and more clearly that to thrive in the upper reaches of business or government, to say nothing of the military, you have to be willing to ruin the lives of or actually kill huge numbers of people without batting an eyelash. If you're a big hotshot CEO, you've got to be perfectly willing to rape the planet, throw tens of people out of work, and spend as little as possible on worker safety. You've got to lie, break promises, use people for your own ends, bribe legislators, cheat your employees out of every dollar possible, all in order to maximize profits. A good profit is no longer enough. What's now required is maximized profit. Anyway, if you do a good job at this, you'll be rewarded more than amply. If you hesitate or show some pangs of conscience, your own masters will soon replace you as CEO with somebody less squeamish. You have to be ruthless and without the slightest hint of a conscience to get even near the top in our culture. Likewise for politicians, who serve both the CEOs and the masters that the CEOs also serve. Joe Lieberman is bad enough, but has there been any president during your lifetime who would hesitate to order the carpet bombing of any banana public in the world just to keep corporate profits up, or else to look tough and decisive prior to the midterm elections? God forbid your party doesn't carry Ohio. Slowly a word crystallized in my mind, and that word is psychopath, or sociopath, which means roughly the same thing. Then I started looking about at what's in print and on the radio, and I found that a large handful of sources had already made the connections between how corporate executives act, and how politicians act, and how psychopaths act. In fact, one of these sources was a distinguished scientific psychiatric researcher who literally wrote the book on psychopaths, name of Dr. Robert Hare. Then one day recently I was reading Counterpunch online, and one issue had no fewer than two articles that repeatedly used the metaphor psychopath to describe their country's foreign and domestic policies. One article was written by the distinguished Israeli journalist Gideon Levy, and published in the respected Israeli newspaper Haaretz. His essay suggested that the policies of the current Israeli government were so self-destructive, that is, destructive of Israel, that the entire government ought to check into a psychiatric hospital for evaluation. The other was an essay by the American nonfiction writer Joe Badgent, author of the well-received book Deer Hunting with Jesus. The essay is way too long to read on the air, but I'll read some good parts of it. We'll also hear from Canadian political and medical activist Dr. Susan Rosenthal, and a few words by Michael Parenti on the intentional drowning of New Orleans. First, a quick definition. I was just kidding about Hannibal Lecter replacing Senator Dodd. A little. According to the Diagnostic Manual of the American Psychiatric Association, a psychopath is not necessarily a serial killer with a chainsaw. The essence of psychopathy is having, quote, a pervasive pattern of disregard for and violation of the rights of others, unquote. The manual lists seven symptoms. Displaying any three of the seven is enough to get you diagnosed as a psychopath. I'll paraphrase just a few. 1. Repeated lying or conning of others for your own gain. 2. Failure to plan ahead. Like, after we overthrow Saddam Hussein, what's our exit strategy? Oh, we'll figure that out when the time comes. 3. Aggressiveness. 4. Reckless disregard for people's safety. Let's stop at 5. Lack of remorse. being indifferent to your crimes and to pain you have caused others. I might add that these very traits, lying, deceiving, disregard for others' safety, indifference to the pain you cause others, lack of any conscience, these very traits aid you as you climb towards the top. You'll rise higher and faster than anybody with a conscience. And you'll use your ill-gotten power to maximize the rewards going to you and to people who share your values, or lack of values. But now let's hear from Dr. Susan Rosenthal from her 2006 book, Power and Powerlessness, read by Lynn Gary in her radio program, Unwelcome Guests, www.unwelcomeguests.org.
Cultivation of the psychopath. If one were to design a human being that was perfectly suited to the capitalist system, that person would be a psychopath. Someone who is disconnected from emotions, having no empathy and no compassion. The American Psychiatric Association defines a psychopath as someone who exhibits, quote, a pervasive pattern of disregard for and violation of the rights of others, as indicated by three or more of the following. Failure to conform to social norms with respect to lawful behaviors, as indicated by repeatedly performing acts that are grounds for arrest. Deceitfulness, as indicated by repeated lying, use of aliases, conning others for personal profit or pleasure. Impulsivity, or failure to plan ahead. Irritability and aggressiveness, as indicated by repeated physical fights or assaults. Reckless disregard for safety of self or others. Consistent irresponsibility, as indicated by repeated failure to sustain consistent work behavior or honor financial obligations. Lack of remorse, as indicated by being indifferent to or rationalizing having hurt, mistreated, or stolen from another. The documentary film The Corporation explains how this definition applies to corporations. Lying, cheating, stealing, hurting people, having a short-term outlook, aggressive behavior, and lack of remorse are standard business practices, making the psychopath the ideal corporate executive. Albert Dunlap, who was described by his biographer as a vicious psychopath, became the darling of the business world during the downsizing frenzy of the 1990s. Dunlap was called Chainsaw Al because he chopped hundreds of thousands of jobs. The more people he laid off, the higher the stock prices climbed. Popular culture presents the psychopath as the villain we love to hate. In the movie Spider-Man, Norman Osborn is a corporate executive whose greed and ambition cause him to develop an evil persona, the Green Goblin. The Goblin is a psychopath who tells Spider-Man, quote, "There are 8 million people in this city, and those teeming masses exist for the sole purpose of lifting exceptional people like us on their shoulders," close quote. Hollywood portrays characters like Norman Osborn as freakish exceptions. In reality, the capitalist can maximize profit only by putting business interests ahead of human needs. To make it in business, all capitalists must behave as if they are psychopaths, whether they are or not. Consider the following example of how one executive was handsomely rewarded for sacrificing children to meet the needs of his corporation. In 2002, Cardinal Bernard F. Law, head of the Archdiocese of Boston, was forced to resign for protecting priests who were sexually molesting children. Law had knowingly moved pedophile priests from parish to parish, where they molested even more children. After Law was disgraced for his role in the child abuse scandal, Pope John Paul II appointed him Archpriest of a basilica in Rome, a highly influential position. Whether or not he was a psychopath, Law advanced his career by behaving like one. Henry Ford, founder of the Ford Corporation, built an automotive empire by sacrificing human lives. He once stated, "I am not in the business of making cars. I am in the business of making profit." This stance required Ford executives to function like psychopaths. Let's say you had a choice between manufacturing a dangerous vehicle or a safe one. What if the dangerous vehicle was more profitable, even after you included the cost of killing and injuring a certain number of people and generating a predictable number of lawsuits? In the late 1960s, the Ford Motor Company launched the Pinto, knowing that a rear-end collision of more than 30 miles an hour would jam its doors and cause a fuel tank explosion that would incinerate the occupants trapped inside. When asked about the Pinto's exploding gas tank, a Ford engineer admitted, quote, "That's all true, that the car tends to explode in minor accidents. But you miss the point entirely. You see, safety isn't the issue, trunk space is. You have no idea how stiff the competition is over trunk space. Do you realize that if we put a Capri-type tank in the Pinto, you could only get one set of golf clubs in the trunk?" Close quote. Ford developed a $6 modification to the Pinto that would prevent the gas tank from exploding. The company then did a cost-benefit analysis based on how many people might die from exploding gas tanks and how much money Ford would have to pay for each death, about $200,000 per person. This sum turned out to be less than the cost of modifying the fuel tanks of all Pintos, so Ford chose not to apply the modification. How many people died as a result? The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration began investigating automobile fires shortly after the Pinto began rolling off the assembly line. Every year, 400,000 cars were catching fire and burning more than 3,000 people to death. Even though Ford made only 24% of the vehicles on American roads, its cars accounted for 42% of collision-ruptured fuel tanks. It took 10 years for the Department of Transportation to declare that the Pinto had a, quote, safety-related defect. 1.5 million vehicles were recalled, and the Ford Motor Company was charged with reckless homicide. However, the judge acquitted Ford on the basis that it could not be convicted for doing what it was designed to do, make a profit. A society that values profit over people needs policymakers who act like psychopaths. Of course, most executives have social values. However, the greatest rewards are reserved for those who are willing to do whatever it takes to get ahead. In a society that rewards greed, good guys finish last. Governments claim to represent all the people. In practice, they serve business first and foremost. That is why the minimum wage is kept at $5.25 an hour and why the rich are showered with billions of dollars in tax cuts. Government loyalty to business is clearest in times of crisis. After the bombing of the World Trade Center, Congress authorized $15 billion in emergency aid to the nation's airlines. Thousands of laid-off airline workers got nothing. Even worse, the government's aid package required airlines to cut the wages and benefits of workers who remained on the job. While Congress took 17 days to rush relief to the airlines, it took 11 months to assemble the first compensation packages for victims' relatives. 25 families were offered a total of $34 million, or less than 0.25% of what the airlines got. More than a year after the tragedy, tens of thousands of people who had applied for emergency assistance were still waiting for their forms to be processed. If 9/11 left any doubts about government priorities, Hurricane Katrina blew them away 4 years later. Public officials knew 3 days in advance that Katrina was going to hit the Gulf Coast. They did nothing. No effort was made to evacuate hundreds of thousands of predominantly poor black people with no way to leave on their own. Sick and disabled people, old people, patients in hospitals and nursing homes, prisoners in locked cells, all were abandoned to the flood. People desperately searching for supplies to survive were branded as looters, and President Bush gave orders to shoot them on sight. After Hurricane Katrina, Congress voted $62 billion to kickstart, quote, "one of the largest reconstruction efforts the world has ever seen," close quote. While well-connected companies lined up for the loot, the poor got a kick in the pants. The Davis-Bacon Act that prohibits employers from paying substandard wages on federally financed projects was suspended for contractors working in the Gulf Coast. New federal contractors were also relieved of any obligation to hire minorities, women, Vietnam veterans, and disabled people on Katrina-related projects. These measures were a boon to business, while forcing those who'd lost everything to work for next to nothing if they could find any work at all. Capitalism subordinates compassion, contributing, and cooperation to the pursuit of profit and blames the resulting social problems on human nature. Politicians know that corporate donations butter their bread and return the favor by opening the public purse for whatever business needs, subsidies, tax cuts, war, etc. Meanwhile, there is no, quote, political will to solve social problems like poverty and unemployment. On the contrary, public officials moan about the deficit and cut funds for education, housing, pensions, social assistance, and Medicare.
Near the end of that passage, Rosenthal discusses businesses and the government's response to the flooding of New Orleans. Michael Parenti has some words on the same subject. Parenti doesn't use the word psychopath. He uses reactionary instead. But it's hard to miss the psychopathic nature of these reactionaries' behavior, as Parenti describes it.
Two more dramatic examples of a nefarious agenda masquerading as incompetence. Katrina, Hurricane Katrina, and 9/11. Now, on Katrina, there wasn't mismanagement in New Orleans. To this day, that's all we hear. He mismanaged it. He dropped the ball. FEMA, what a mess. FEMA performed brilliantly. FEMA stopped every bit of aid from going into New Orleans. They consistently made decisions that were consistent and ruthless. Medical aid, rescue teams, food pouring in from all over the United States were held off while the medical personnel in the Astrodome were begging for help and assistance. They weren't given any. More concern was given to crowd control and looters. There was more patrols going around ready to shoot people than to rescue them, and people were dying in their flooded attics. Scores of people died because things weren't being done. They broke New Orleans. They broke that heavy Democratic community, which, by the way, used to swing the state of Louisiana into the Democratic column every so often. There's even a quote, which I have, something I'm writing now, from one of the right-wing local politicians. We wanted God to clean all these people out of the housing projects and all, and we couldn't do it, but God did. And it was proof that government doesn't work. That was the other thing. New Orleans was not destroyed by Katrina, you understand. It was destroyed by flood when the levees broke, and everybody knew that was going to happen and had reported it and all that. All right, this is what I say very briefly. To be sure, government does not work, certainly not when it is in the hands of reactionaries who have no desire to see it work. New Orleans was victimized by those right-wing ideologues who opposed the idea that government can be a salutary force in regard to social needs and human services. The White House reactionaries would be quite content to demonstrate that government is not to be counted on when it comes to helping communities, especially low-income and ethnic minority communities that are Democratic strongholds. So that's what happened. That's my explanation of New Orleans.
One of the best tour guides to a land ruled by the psychopaths for the psychopaths is James McMurtry. What happens when nature and history and enraged citizens finally start cracking apart the system? Don't worry, the debutante ball will continue until the chandelier crashes. Here's McMurtry's Dancing in the Ruins of the Realm.
Too late. Driving a rose through old Bombay. Rickshaw drivers in my way. his noble cause. Standing on the banks of the river Shane, ain't got tethers to my name. I stand my ground and I cast my net, dancing in the ruins where the sun don't set. Dancing in the ruins of the crown, infield rifles keeping us down. In a shotgun shack on a two-lane road, smack in the middle of the Bible Belt, dancing in the ruins all by myself. We got the National Guard with the bayonets, we got the Ten Commandments on the State House steps. We shout not steal and we shout not kill, dancing in the ruins of our own free will. Dancing in the ruins of the South, Confederate flag taped over my mouth. We thank thee, Lord, for all we got, while the multinational call the shots. So scrape them hides and clean that slate, dancing in the ruins of the nation state. We'll fight them on the land and fight them in the air. Little cowboy says we gotta fight them over there. You ain't seen nothing like it since Saigon fell. Dancing in the ruins, cause we might as well. Dancing in the ruins of the realm, a fool and a madman at the helm. Dancing in the ruins of the Reich, down in the bunker on a hunger strike.
Here's Joe Badgett in Fine Feather and High Dudgeon. This selection is from his essay, Bass Boats and Queer Marriage, neither of which happen to be mentioned in this selection. Both political parties keep assuring us that the great American middle-class lifestyle is not negotiable, then proceed to negotiate the hell out of it. Political assurances of the sanctity of the middle class come down to promising that the 6% of the world's population called Americans may continue to rip through 36% of the Earth's resources in its endless pursuit of obesity and carcinogenic intake, not to mention taking everybody else out with us in the process through ecocide. Nobody but an unmitigated psychopath would even make such a case, much less hawk it to the American people as being in their best interests. In their best interests to wipe out our dwindling planetary sustenance and to bleep off the rest of the world enough that a significant number are willing to strap on explosives and buy a plane ticket to the States. Unfortunately, the psychopaths are in charge, and they are charging all over the rest of us like rutting bull elephants on Jimson weed. There doesn't seem to be enough Thorazine on Earth to take them down. Consequently, their delusions have escalated to the point where they believe they are exempt from planetary catastrophe. But when the planet's condition gets bad enough, and that appears to be sometime next week, their children may not be exempt. This, of course, matters not a twit to a psycho, especially if the psycho is rich, powerful, and saluted by media networks wherever he or she goes, and has not the faintest clue that he or she is a psycho to begin with. The or she refers to Nancy Pelosi, Hillary Clinton, Sarah Palin, or any of the other power-crazed, warped-out bitches who have slit enough throats to make it into that gladiatorial arena inside the Beltway. White males by no means have a franchise on naked political bloodlust. America's constellation of psychos includes just about everybody with a few hundred million bucks behind their hallucinations, from Oprah Winfrey up to Ben Bernanke. Such people presume their anointment to rule. And why shouldn't they? They've experienced nothing but success through gaming the system and the rest of humanity, raping the proles in the ear and running the nation and its institutions for their own benefit as elites. Needless to say, they do not see things that way. To them, it's just the natural order of the universe. When you are urinating down on the world from the balcony of your suite on the 44th floor, it's hard to be humble or concerned about the pissant swarm on the streets below. Even if you're not the kind of psycho our political system attracts and legitimizes, it isn't easy. Our system, owing to the magic of its checks and balances, holds all possible solutions. So we must work within the system for any desired change. So the big shots advise us. Next, the big political players, Republican and Democrat, determine some minute variation on the most current lies being sold. These slight variations are proclaimed as profound differences between the parties, because both parties' role on the political stage is to play act as opponents. So cosmetic differences are netted out and then savagely contested in the theater state as life or death issues for the American people. If you have watched old mob movies, you know that any racket needs a front. In America, the front is called democracy. Like the term populism, the people have no idea what democracy really is, but they believe it has something to do with free market capitalism. So the people are given such narrow electoral choices as not to be even real choices, but packaged in somewhat different wrappers, such as skin color. Or, if a president and Congress can see a clear path in just rolling over the rabble are given no choice at all, such as going to war against Iraq. Joe Badgent. See Counterpunch online for more, much more in the same vein. For more by Dr. Susan Rosenthal, head over to susanrosenthal.com. The Parenti recording, courtesy of Mariah Gillardin's TUC Radio, www.tucradio.org. And thank you, dear listener, for listening. New World Notes comes to you from the East of the River Satellite Studio and Skunk Works of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. The opinions expressed are my own, though keep in mind that it was Joe Badgent, not I, who called Hillary and Nancy Pelosi warped-out bitches. I would have called them something less sexist, like devils from the bowels of hell. It'll get to my non-carborundum, and please tune in again next week. Ciao.
We thank the Lord for all we got. While the multinationals call the shots. So scrape them hides and clean that slate. Dancing in the ruins of the nation state. We'll fight them on the land. Little cowboy says we gotta fight.